So we would like to welcome you to our first K-12 open source Skype interview. This is an opportunity that we have to interview people who are making a difference in the use of open source software in K-12 schools. I'm Steve Hargadon, and I have a small company in California that helps underfunded schools use open source technology. Miguel, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. This is Miguel Gulen. I work as a director of instructional technology for a San Antonio, Texas school district. And I'm really excited, not just because David Thornburg is here, but because everybody else is here, especially one of the people that introduced me to free open source software, especially Linux and all that, a guy by the name of Greg Rodriguez. So I just thought I'd share that, and I'm glad to be here and that we're starting off this wonderful series with David.
So our special guest tonight is Dr. David Thornburg, who's the author of the recent book, When the Best is Free, An Educator's Perspective on Open Source Software. We owe a great debt of gratitude to Dr. Thornburg because he started us off as well at the Open Source Lab at the National Educational Computing Convention in San Diego last month, and or early this month, and really helped to set a great tone for enthusiasm and interest in open source software at that conference. So, David, glad to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm thrilled to be part of this, and just thrilled to be part of the community that's making a difference in the lives of children all over the world. This is truly a global phenomenon. The United States is actually showing up a little bit late to the party, quite frankly, but that doesn't diminish the excitement and the opportunity, not by a long shot.
Well, we thought we would give you a few minutes to give kind of a brief overview of your relationship and role with open source software. When you have finished with that, we will go into a little bit of a Q&A session, which we anticipate will last about 30 minutes. And then we should have about 15 minutes to open up the Skype cast to those who are currently muted to allow them to ask some questions. So would you tell us what open source software is and how you have developed a relationship with it?
Sure. Well, you know, open source software is really a way of history going back to its origins in some way. Back in the early 1970s, late 60s, when programmers created software, it was generally the practice that people just shared their code with other people. And then suddenly somebody got the idea that software was itself something that could be protected and sold commercially. And so proprietary software came into existence. It's hard to put a date on it, but I'd say certainly by the mid-70s, that was starting to happen. And I'm talking about even in the corporate world, in the world of mainframes, which was largely all there was. I was part of the team at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in the 70s, spent 10 years there. And I got to see some wonderful stuff get invented, including the modern graphical user interface. The mouse didn't get invented there, but certainly it got refined and improved there. Laser printer was invented there. The Ethernet was invented there. All kinds of things we take for granted today were invented in a lab that I was thrilled to be part of for a decade. And software traveled through this fledgling network that was funded by ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, and today, formed the foundation of the Internet. So people were sharing software and ideas and whatnot all around the world with each other. And it was a very exciting time to be in the world of computing. And when I entered the world of educational computing, starting in the late 70s, early 80s, I saw something that was very similar in that teachers were creating programs of their own, often in BASIC, because that was the only language that was shipped on the personal computers available at the time. And they would be selling this software at conferences in Ziploc bags, basically for duplication costs. I mean, my feeling is I can afford to give stuff away. I can't afford to pay people to take it. So it's okay to, you know, to recover your costs. But there was a sense of sharing of happiness and joy at the discoveries that people were making about computers and kids. And that went on in the personal computing world around education, certainly from 1980, let's say, up until maybe the mid-80s. And by that time, larger commercial companies, many of them having made their mark in the corporate sector, decided to enter into the education domain. And they did this with shrink-wrapped, beautiful four-color boxes and of software that had prices ranging from $20 all the way up to several hundred dollars. And at that point, we started seeing more and more concern about copy protection and everything else, because there were corporations that had a legitimate expectation, because it was their choice, that their software not be copied and not distributed. So the thing that has made open source interesting to me right now is that it not only rekindles some of the adventuresome spirit that we had in the 70s and early 80s, especially around titles that are good for use in education, but it addresses some of the financial concerns for commodity software that can be really staggering now. I mean, the issue about how many computers we're able to put in the hands of kids is going to be largely dictated not just by the price of the hardware, but also by the annual cost of software licenses, which could become quite formidable. And we're seeing software licenses, let's say for Windows XP, for example, in the mid-70 dollar range, so $74, $75 per computer per year just to keep your Windows XP license. A little bit under $70 a year just to keep a license on Microsoft Office. Well, if you've only got a couple of labs full of computers, it's not that much money. But if you're talking about putting a computer in the hands of every child in the school or every child in the district or every child in the state, that becomes a very significant expenditure. And if there's software or operating systems that work at least as well as the commercial products that don't have costs associated with them, then why not use those? So that was kind of my motivation for revisiting all of this. We certainly saw some exciting stuff going on with Indiana, where they're embarked on a project that ultimately will have installed 300,000 Linux-based computers in the high schools in the state. They're not at that level now, but that's certainly where they're heading. And we're seeing other states, New Hampshire, for example, doing work in that area. It's interesting to just see what's happening on the open source front. It's really starting to take hold. And with the federal money having dropped so low as it has, I don't think we have much choice now but to start looking at open source.
David, do you mind if I ask you a quick question? With one of the folks in the chat room asked, why is the United States slower to responding to free open source software, especially when you look at all the benefits that we have? Why are we so slow on the uptake, I guess?
Well, I'm not sure. I think some of it is because there's the idea that we can't afford proprietary software, or at least we should be able to afford it, and we have our very legitimate pride in our American corporations and their capacity to generate returns for their stockholders and all of that good stuff. There are other countries who have embraced open source purely for financial reasons, because they never had the resources to actually become legal with proprietary titles. I mean, make no mistake about it, you go into countries like Malaysia and you'll see a tremendous number of people running Windows on their computers, but you could bet that a lot of those copies of Windows are not properly licensed. Those are bootleg copies. I've been in department stores in some cities in Malaysia that are five floors and just shop after shop after shop selling bootleg software. Well, you know, that's wrong. And open source provides a nice way for people to get all the functionality that they're looking for, but to do it legally at the same time. And so I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing some nations move very strongly into this domain. Let's also not forget the reliability issue. Linux is amazingly reliable when you put it up against Windows XP. In fact, it's really interesting because one of the questions I get is Linux really ready for the desktop? You know, people hear about problems, they say, well, Linux isn't ready for the desktop. Well, come on, you know, every time you install a piece of software in Windows and you get a missing DLL error, nobody stops and says, well, maybe Windows isn't ready for the desktop. It's nonsense, but it's just sort of what you're used to, and you tend to stay in your comfort zone. And so in the States, when we start promoting open source software, it moves people out of their comfort zone enough that they become a little resistant and almost non-believing. They can't believe that stuff this good would be available for free.
So just to recap, what are the top benefits for K-12 schools or K-16 schools in adopting open source?
Well, let's leave cost out, because I mean that's an obvious one. I mean, you can save on the cost front, you could save let me do the math quickly, about $150 per computer per year on your Microsoft licenses. This is assuming you have Office and XP. So you save that much money per computer per year, and then in terms of the non-annual, the buyout licenses on your other software, things like Photoshop Elements and programs of that sort that could be replaced with open source products like GIMP, you know, you're going to save several hundred more dollars per computer at the time that you purchase the software. So the cost saving is a given. But the thing that's interesting for me is the way I create Linux systems here in the office is I take an old laptop that has just given up the ghost, and it just became so sluggish and so sloppy and just compared to anything I want to run today, just incapable of meeting the needs. And I just take my formatter, completely reformat the drive, put a fresh version of Linux on it with all my applications, and I end up with a machine that is not only faster than a more modern laptop, but also more reliable in terms of not having the thing crash on me. And ultimately, what schools have to think about is the total cost of ownership. And that means not just your startup costs, but what does it cost to keep this stuff up and running? I'm a big fan of the Ubuntu flavor of Linux, in particular Edubuntu, and my experience has been that the package manager does a brilliant job of keeping track of new releases of upgrades for software, handling the installations cleanly, and so that it's almost that I don't have to do anything to end up with a system that's just totally spiffed out and operating fresh and beautiful every day. And that's a big win for schools.
It is. One of the questions that a gentleman by the name of Ted Youngblood, who's in Waller ISD in Texas, asked is, how do schools move to an open source environment when 95% of the available titles are from commercial vendors and have no open source equivalent?
Well, you know, that's when I first got that question, I thought about it for a minute, and I'm not going to argue with the number. 95% of the titles have no open source equivalent. In a very strict sense of the word, that's probably true. In other words, if I'm looking for a title that is going to teach me the conjugation or working with the subjunctive or something in Latin. I don't even know if Latin has a subjunctive, but let's pretend it does. Then you're right. I probably won't be able to find that in the open source world easily. But let's start with the bread and butter applications. The bread and butter applications are the ones that you need to be thinking about, where you spend 90% of your time. And then when you get enough Linux machines in the hands of schools, there'll be enough pressure on the software vendors to take those titles and to get them ported over so that they will run. Let me give you a case in point. Visual Thesaurus, which is a very popular program, exists both as an online version as well as a desktop version. I'm a huge fan of the desktop version. I have the desktop version running on my Linux machine as a Linux app. Now, they haven't probably announced this to the general public, so I'll do it for them, because I know I have their permission to do that. But because it's a job, because they wrote Visual Thesaurus in pure Java, all I had to do was have them build a package for me that double-checked that I had the right versions of Java installed, etc. And it took just a few hours, and all of a sudden they took code that was already running on Windows and Macintosh and were able to, in addition, have it running on Linux. Now, they wouldn't have done this if it was just David Thornburg calling them up and saying, gee, I'd really like to run this software on Linux. But when you've got the state of Indiana that ultimately is going to have 300,000 Linux machines and you want to be in any high school in that entire state, you're going to have Linux versions of your software because that's the only kinds of machines that are going to be there. So the short answer to your question is that for this next year, that argument is probably true to some extent. But, you know, we've got multiple platforms in our schools anyway. There are usually some places, even in a school that says that it's all Mac, where there's a couple of Windows machines. Vice versa is also true. Places that are all Windows probably have some Macs hanging out someplace. So why not have Linux machines coexisting with everything else so that the stuff that only runs on Macs or only runs on Windows continues to do that until replacements are there? And I don't mean necessarily free replacements. I'm just talking about even commercial ones. Because, quite frankly, if I don't have to pay for my word processor, spreadsheet, database, presentation tool, and a whole bunch of other graphics editors and all those kinds of things, that frees up a bunch more money for me to buy proprietary software. And there will always be a market for proprietary software. This isn't going to put companies out of business as long as they realize they need to support another operating system.
David, this is Steve again.
Hi.
So, I think you've brought up a really good point, and one I've heard you express before, and maybe we could focus a little bit on now. But open source isn't just Linux, and so obviously there are a lot of open source programs which are available on the Windows or the Mac in the Mac environment. And this is not necessarily an all or nothing decision to move toward open source. Could you describe some of the ways that that schools that would be reluctant to move to Linux could start using open source software programs on the Windows and Mac platforms that would be very useful to them?
Sure. I think the first thing to do is to start taking a look at programs like an Office suite. OpenOffice is a perfect example of this. To start with, everybody knows what an Office suite does. They also know how expensive they are. And if you say, here's an open source Office suite, which is not only backwards compatible with Microsoft products, just to give an example, but also does some things that your Microsoft product doesn't do very nicely, or in some cases doesn't even do at all. And once you get people used to that and comfortable with that, saying, oh, that's not bad, then you start taking a look at other open source cross-platform software. And that would include things like GIMP, Scribus, Inkscape, a whole bunch of them. My book talks about quite a few, in fact, that have the requirement to be in that book that they run equally well on Macintosh, Linux, and Windows. So I feel very strongly that this cross-platform open source movement is the right way to get started. Now, there's some immediate benefits that come when you're using the same software across different operating systems, especially when the software also happens to be free. And one of the immediate benefits is that teachers now have the right, even the invitation, to make copies of these programs, give them to the kids to take home and install on their home machines. So let's say that you're an all-Mac school and some of your kids have Windows machines at home. They could use the same software on their computer at home that they're using at school, and so you don't have to worry about differences in how the software works or where various menu items are located, things of that sort. It's basically the same stuff. That's a huge plus. It's a huge plus for staff developers who work across platforms. Because, again, when you have cross-platform open source software, you don't care what the operating system is. And so those are sort of two major benefits. But I think the real good starting point is to say whatever computer operating system you're using, we're going to start out being platform agnostic. We don't care what that is. But we do care about is that you give open source software a try just to see if it meets your needs. And I can't imagine it not meeting the needs that the software was designed to address.
So I'm going to recommend a couple of quick links. One is to our k12opensource.com website, where we hope that we're not only providing a platform for people to read about open source software programs that they could implement quickly, but also to communicate experiences that they've had successfully in using open source software so that others are in a position to see that. And the other link is to the opencd.org, which is a fairly well-known project, but it's you can go there and download a full CD of software that will run, I think primarily in Windows, opencd.org. And it gives you a chance to actually try these programs out. And then, again, this could be freely copied and given to students who then have the access to using what might otherwise be very expensive programs at home.
I think that's wonderful, Steve. And also, I have a new website that's just limping up now called TCPD Podcast. TCPD as in Thornburg Center for Professional Development. Go www.tcpdpodcast.org and click on the open source page, and I have links to about 15 open source projects, all of them software that runs on all three platforms. Doesn't matter Mac, Windows, or Linux. So I think those types of resources in the hands of teachers will at least encourage them to experiment, try stuff out.
Yeah, that link on the wiki for this interview. Go to the page for interviews on K-12 course under Thornburg. You'll see a link to a wiki, and I placed the link to the TCPDpodcast.org there.
Great. I'd like to share a question with you, David, from Tom Hoffman, who is working on a school tool project. He says, in the short term, it makes sense to advocate for free in-cost applications like NetLogo and Education. But in the long run, we want such projects to be released under open source licenses. What can we do to make it more likely that non-commercial educational applications like NetLogo will be done as open source projects in the future?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I sent that very question to Yuri Walensky over at Northwestern about NetLogo specifically. And I think what he's doing right now is the only reason that the code hasn't been released into the open source community is that a bunch of his graduate students are still working on it. They've got a very, very active user community, and they are adding new primitives to the language themselves as part of some larger research projects, funded research projects, is my guess, that they have going on. I haven't driven over to Northwestern to visit with Yuri yet. We're trying to set up a time to do that. But it's a topic I certainly intend to pursue with him. For example, NetLogo is in some way a fork off of the StarLogo project from MIT, and StarLogo was just turned into an open source project within the last 2 weeks, as I recall. So there is a migration path for people to let the code get released to the community at large, and I think that will happen. Now, quite frankly, from an educator's perspective, as long as there is an active development community that is just staying on top of the code, making it as good as they possibly can, putting out regular upgrades, responding quickly to user concerns and especially to bugs. And by quickly, I mean typically within a day or two. In that environment, most teachers won't care if they personally have access to the source code. Not a lot of teachers in schools that are going to sit down and look at that source code and do very much with it, is my guess. The benefit of having that source code open, though, is that all those millions of eyeballs around the world that are playing with the software, if they find bugs in it, and they are so inclined, have the opportunity to go in and fix it themselves. That's the benefit of true open source. I think there will come a time when NetLogo, this is just my guess, and I certainly can't speak for Yuri, but it's my guess that there will come a time that they will say, yes, we're done enough with this now that we want the world to take it over, because we want to move on to other things perhaps, and then it will be released into open source. I think that will happen.
Okay. I'd like to sort of follow up with another question from the Director of Technology Services in Texas again. One-to-one computing is the current hot topic in educational technology, and I've read with great interest some of the things that you've written about this, and several states have done pilots on various scales, and some districts have jumped in district-wide with these implementations. One common theme is the lack of long-term political support and funding for this type of endeavor. The recent movement to end Title II Part D funding was one example of that. How do you see schools moving beyond the current environment when any long-term funding is such an uncertainty?
Well, I mean, I think that the only thing you can do is move beyond the current environment. I mean, the current environment stinks, and as you said, it's going to get worse in terms of funding. Every year, Norma, my wife, and I go to Washington, D.C. As part of COSIN and walk through the halls of Congress trying to get educational technology funding restored, and every year we almost leave in tears because people in Congress don't get it. There's sort of the belief in the current administration that we have met our technology infrastructure goals and it's time to move on. And it's interesting, just to add fuel to this fire, I have a graph that I just updated today because new data came out that talks about the student computer ratio in the United States of America. And it dropped like a rock from the 80s down to about, in the 1980s, it was late 80s, it was about 63 students for one computer. It's currently at 4-1. What's interesting is that it's been at 4-1 for the last 4 years. That 4-1 student computer ratio is a barrier. And people talk about the personal computer revolution. I'm sorry, 25% penetration is not a revolution. We've got 75% more to go. So the one-to-one initiatives, you're right, they are getting attention, and for good reasons. And that's, of course, what, in their own way, Indiana's trying to do, although they're doing it from desktops, not from laptops at this point. And there needs to be a way to do this. I can't imagine a way to do it that doesn't make active use of open source software. And quite frankly, I can't think of a way to do it that doesn't use Linux, because otherwise it's just not affordable. You take a look at the total cost of a machine that's sitting there in the form of software licenses, it's pretty high. So it's probably, I'm making a guess here, that probably 50% of the total cost of a machine is its software, and I'm talking about a fully loaded machine. So in that basis, you could get twice as many computers if the software that was installed was all open source, and particularly free open source software.
David, we've got about 5 more minutes before we're going to open up for questions. I wanted to ask a question I think is on a lot of people's minds that came from Ted at Waller ISD. And he asks, how do schools transition to open source software when they typically have lower levels of technical support staff than they have for proprietary software?
Well, that's a puzzling question to me, because Steve, I'm not sure that the support needs are higher with open source. In fact, they probably aren't higher at all. There's some staff development that's probably needed along the way to get people started with it. But my experience has been that the stuff that I use anyway just seems to work. I don't have strange software crashes. So I'm not sure that the support demands would be higher at all. I think if anything, the support needs might be lower, but I don't know for sure. Was there something specific or an example that he had in mind, do you know?
Well, I think it's a pretty common question and one that I face a fair amount. And typically when technical support people are hired at schools, they're long-term employees and expect to be there for a lifetime or for a very long time.
Sure.
And if they don't know Linux and they've been trained in the Windows environment or in proprietary software, then oftentimes I get the impression that schools face a little bit of a hurdle from their own technical staff. I did see a great example of one way to solve this from Brent Farr in Yuma, Arizona, because I would sense that most technical staff have an interest in Linux and are interested in finding out what's going on with open source software. And he did a very good job of involving his technical staff early on in any kind of transitions that were made and then let them kind of lead the way. Because mm-hmm. they were enthusiastic about Linux, but they just didn't want to be left behind.
I think that's exactly the right approach to take. And by the way, if people are staying away from Linux because they're fearful of change, I don't know how to break this to you, but when Vista comes out, it's going to be an unmitigated disaster. To start with, most schools in the United States do not have computers capable of even running Vista. And according to the people I've talked to who've been testing it, it's an absolute dog right now. I mean, I've heard nothing good about it. But you know that once Vista gets out, support for XP is going to start to go away, and Microsoft is going to try to once again control the market, force people to upgrade to hardware they can't afford, and do a bunch of other things. And I see that as a golden opportunity next year when Vista comes out to go into schools in a big way and say, look, since you're thinking of changing operating systems anyway, how would you like to see an operating system environment that runs on the hardware you already own and makes it perform like hardware that you can't even afford to buy?
Could one final question then before we go to questions and answers. Bryant Patent brought up a subject on the questions online that I think is a very good one, and since probably many who will listen to this podcast will end up being in the open source community already, what message could you bring from the educators to those who were in the open source world of things that can be done to help improve the assimilation of open source software in the academic environment?
Well, I think one of the things, and this is sort of a mixed bag in terms of open source products, but one of them is to create open source software that's not only functional but also elegant. Let me give you an example of this. I'm a big fan of CMAP as a concept mapping tool. It was developed by Joseph Novak, who's one of the co-developers of concept mapping. It does a whole bunch of things that Inspiration does not do at all, that Inspiration at this moment is incapable of doing. But it is not elegant. Inspiration is an absolutely elegant piece of software. It's beautiful. It has a nice look and feel to it. It's terrific. And sometimes people forget that elegance is a good thing. Functionality is essential, of course. But beyond pure functionality, having stuff that looks cool and is fun to play with and let's users do a bunch of exciting things that you might not have anticipated ahead of time, that's a huge plus. So that would be some advice I would give to people developing open source software, not just for education, but quite frankly for any market. Functionality has tended to be the driving force, and it still needs to be a major one, but I think elegance is important as well.
Good, thank you for that. So I'm hoping that we'll overcome our greenness in technology to be able to now unmute people who might have an interest in asking a question to Dr. Thornburg. So I show that everybody is muted, and if somebody would like to ask a question, go ahead and try and request the microphone, and we'll see if we can get you on. And if that doesn't work, I will unmute everyone and see where we go from there.
All right.
I'm not getting I may be doing something wrong, so I'm going to unmute, and if you'd be polite enough to each other, it looks like Daniel's asking for the mic. Oh, it's working. Hang on. Daniel, are you on?
I don't know. Am I?
Yes, you are.
Ah, very good. First of all, thanks to you, Steve, for setting this up. Great idea for open source evangelizing. And David, very glad to meet you, and actually quite an honor. And my question really relates to one of the biggest problems that we had in converting, although we did succeed, and there's a long story there, you'll probably hear about it the next one of these, in converting the mindset of the IT folks. And really, it wasn't the technicians. A lot of the lower-level IT staff were actually quite familiar with Unix or Linux, other sorts of things like that, and were big fans as soon as they heard about it. It's really the higher-level decision-makers. And I think, some of it is the nobody got fired for buying IBM mentality. Others of it may be fear, uncertainty, and doubt, that sort of thing. But what have you learned from seeing cases of the best practices for convincing IT decision makers to move to open source?
Well, that's a terrific question, and I don't have enough data points to really give a solid answer to it, but I'll share a couple of quick insights. To start with, when you have got good leadership, miracles can happen. One of the reasons that the Indiana Project is where it is because of Laura Taylor, and especially because of Mike Huffman, who's the head of that whole project and is sort of the chief technology guy for the state education system, and works directly with the state superintendent on a regular basis. We're starting to see that in a couple of other states as well, and one of which I can't talk about right now may come online in another couple of months. It'll just be breathtaking when it does. So you have to have that leadership. The question that you raised, though, has to do with the FUD business, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. And I try to address that a couple of ways. And the most typical question that I get is, if this stuff is free, how can it be any good? And of course, the answer is because it's created by people who are passionate about it, who are relying on the software for their own use, and they're not going to create junk. I mean, when they're building a house, they're not building a house for you, they're building a house for them. And while they're doing it, it's a house that can be replicated very easily, and suddenly it's yours, it's your house, it's everybody else's house. So they're not creating this software to maximize shareholder profits or anything like that. They're creating it because there's some functionality that they really wanted to have and wanted to be sure that the software really performed beautifully. So that's one of the ways to start addressing some of the yabbits, because everybody's going to say, yeah, but what about this? Yeah, but what about that? There are going to be people that no matter how much you converse with them, they're not going to want to change their perspective. And in that case, you can just have to point to examples of places that have done large-scale implementations and made it work. I'm not positive, but I think as of this moment, there are 21,000 Linux machines in Indiana high schools. And they're in the process, if memory serves, of converting 5 classrooms per school per year to Linux, so that there's the Linux box on every desktop in those rooms, on every single desktop in those rooms. Now, that's a pretty massive undertaking. And that type of project at that size shows that shifting to a new operating system is scalable, and it's affordable, it's reliable, it's got all the right characteristics. And I really think we all need to tip our hats to Mike Hoffman and his team for showing that it can be done, because it's making it easier for some of those other folks that you talked about to say, hey, you know what, there may be something to this. Now, there are other ways to go. What happened in Brazil, and I'm not suggesting this is the right way to do it, but what happened in Brazil was there was just a decree from the president of the country saying, we're shifting to Linux, period. End of story. That does accomplish the result, but it doesn't necessarily build happy campers in the process. So I think there's a way of saying, yes, this is something we really want to look at seriously, and to get people at least doing pilot projects and get them involved early on these projects so that their voice gets heard, and then take it from there.
I agree completely. That's a great answer, by the way. Letting them see it is the best way to battle a lot of the FUD.
Daniel, thanks for asking the question. I'm going to let those who are listening know that next week, which is August 3rd, 2006, Daniel will be on being interviewed along with Jim McQuillan, who's the head of the Linux Terminal Server Project, which is Linux Thin Client. And we'll have a fun opportunity to converse some more there. And also, Mike Hoffman has agreed to let me and Miguel interview him within the next few weeks, and so we should have him online fairly soon, and there'll be lots of good questions for him. Do we have any other questions for Dr. Thornburg? So while we're waiting, I there's one that I can ask, David. Oh, here's David coming online. Hang on. David, are you there?
I am indeed. How are you?
Oh, you sound good. Fine, thank you.
USB microphone.
Did you want to ask
Hello, Dr. Thornburg. How are you doing tonight?
I'm just fine, David. Where are you located?
I'm in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island.
Okay.
I work here at the university and also do a little bit of online work with various open source projects. I also spent a year banging my head against my various distroed desktops and ended up back with Windows on my as my main computer. I've got a little Mac laptop and I've got another Ubuntu desktop over here. I completely agree that in terms of setting up an LTSP or setting up computer labs, that Linux is ready. But you said earlier that you think it is ready as a desktop product. And to me, my concern in my advocacy of open source is that in saying that to a university administrator at my school and then dropping them in front of a Linux box driven system, that doesn't always play itself out. Do you think that when you say that, do you mean in terms of having experts come in and set up an LTSP or do that stuff, or do you really mean that you think that Linux is ready to go as a, like, say, SUSE or Ubuntu is ready to go across the board to compete face-to-face with OS X and with XP?
I would say that certainly within a year, as there's more applications, more specialized applications out, that will be the case. Right now, as far as an operating environment goes, I use Edubuntu, which is the K-12 version of Ubuntu.
That's actually what's on my box,
yeah. Yeah, and are you using Dapper Drake, the latest release?
I haven't upgraded, no.
Okay. Well, but even Breezy Badger was good, and it's even, you know, it's even slicker now. I mean, it's I have had zero problems with it. I haven't had a single crash. Let me give you an example. This telephone call is, I've been on this for about an hour because we started early. On my Windows machine, I would have had a Skype crash by now. And that's because of all the other software that I installed on that machine that when I got rid of it, the bad stuff didn't go away. I mean, the Linux world is just so much cleaner and so much easier for me. And what teachers and students really care about is when you turn this stuff on, does it work? And the answer for me is yes, it does. It's working beautifully. There are parts that are going to be easier in the future, like building launchers and whatnot. I'm always installing stuff from the terminal. I don't expect teachers to do that. I don't think that's a fair expectation. I don't think they should have to. But as people start developing packages, they'll make it easier and easier for people to install it just the way you install any other software. So, yes, I honestly believe that it's ready for the desktop. I may be a little ahead on that prediction, but within a year, I would say, why did we ever think it wasn't the case?
Okay. I don't know that... I don't mean to disagree with you, but
I do mean to disagree with you.
I literally spent a year through five distros going piece to piece, and I do probably 4 or 5 hours of Skype audio recorded every week and have never had Skype crash on me and had it crash over and over and over and over again on Edubuntu. And I do think that there are a lot of things that Linux, I mean, certainly I would never have a server on Windows. Certainly, I have on the three desktops in my office, one of them is running SUSE, and it works fine. It does certain things, but I think in terms of being able to go out into the world and collaborate, there has to be a larger mass movement. I mean, I'm perfectly willing to say that there's a possibility of it being able to compete, but while 90% of the people out there, 95% of the people out there are using Windows-based products, and while so much of the software available online is Windows-based, and I mean, if you take a piece of software, a comparative piece of software from a website, and you pull it down onto your desktop, let's say you take Audacity off of SourceForge, which works on all three platforms,
right.
It is not as easy to install on Ubuntu as it is to install on Windows. It simply is not, and it's even easier on OS X. And that's where my concern comes in. And saying that it is as easy, that has not been my experience.
All I have to do to my experience with Dapper Drake when I installed Audacity was I go to the Synaptic Package Manager on the search field. I type in Audacity, and it immediately points to it. And then I just say install, and that's it. I mean. Period. It's done. And that's all I had to do. It worked fine.
That's the Debian-based apt-get, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we only have
except you don't even have to type that in because the Synaptic Package Manager does all that for you.
David, we only have a couple of minutes left.
Okay.
I don't mean to interrupt this interesting dialogue.
No.
I would like to put out my
email address so people so we can continue this online.
Well, I think that's a great idea and a generous one. And one thing I will say is, having done installations of Linux Thin Client for schools, is that if you prepare people well enough to understand where Linux and open source really does serve a great purpose and works very well, and you let them know where it may still have some difficulties or may not be as easy as some of the Windows or other commercial programs.
Sure.
With those parameters in place, my experiences have been overwhelmingly positive. You know, to have school labs that run for months and months without ever having a problem, you know, that's just a wonderful thing for a school. And I tell them, you know, very specifically, you know, in our family, we don't just drive one car. We have two different cars, and one's a larger car that's more expensive and guzzles gas, and one's an older, much less expensive but very functional car. And we use them for different purposes. And as long as you're not locked into all or nothing, I think you'll find that open source software, in many cases, performs beautifully, and where it doesn't, don't use it yet, and wait for it to get better. Does that help to bridge that gap a little?
Couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
Great question. Great dialogue.
I don't disagree with that. But I think we are getting closer with every release.
I definitely agree with that. I'm using Ubuntu Dapper Drake, and I've been really thrilled with the improvement. I think I started. This is Miguel, by the way. I started with Ubuntu several versions ago, and they've gotten progressively better. Dapper Drake has gotten so much easier. I mean, it's a dramatic improvement, I think, from Breezy Badger. And I encourage you to try it out, Dave. Audacity, all the other programs. You can even get a little script that will facilitate everything. I know the Linux purists... Oh, the Linux purists probably jump on my case about this, but there's something called Get Automatics, and I'll put that in the wiki as one of the links. But you download that, and it takes care of doing 99% of the stuff that you need. But we're still going to encounter obstacles because, you know, you saw all the trouble we went through in trying to figure out how to do recording on Skype on Ubuntu. So it's possible, doable, but not necessarily going to work in every single situation. But we're almost, I think, if we want to use it for what most teachers use the technology for, then it's ready. It's only when we start getting into things like digital storytelling that we start to see that the tools aren't there. But I'm right. Sorry, I couldn't hold my tongue. I had to speak up on that.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So, Miguel, why don't we go ahead and close, giving our thanks to Dr. Thornburg and maybe giving you a little bit of time for a wrap-up here. I also want to plug your book again, Free, and I think to order it, all people have to do is to go to your website, which is on the wiki.
Actually, they go to the TCPD podcast website, and there's ordering information there on the open source page.
Terrific. I do want to mention that we'll have Jim McQuillan on and Daniel Howard next week and hopefully a couple of other good fun guests with regard to Linux Think Client, and then have had a nice dialogue with Mike Huffman today who will be on within the next few weeks. So, David, would you like to close us here?
Well, sure. I think that this is a very exciting time to be in educational computing. You know, lots of us are going to get our elbows and knees scraped as we're working through all of this. But in another year or so, we're going to all be able to stand back and say, you know, we were there at the dawn of a revolution that's going to transform the life of children all over the planet. And that's an unmitigated good thing in my book. So I thank all of you for joining, and I look forward to seeing you at various conferences as I travel around the world, and hope our paths cross sooner rather than later.
Thank you so much. Thanks to everyone who joined on the call, and we'll look forward to future interviews and future opportunities to continue this dialogue.
Steve, thank you for taking this on and helping organize everything. You did a fantastic job. And folks that are listening, you need to know that Steve did a tremendous job in putting all this together. I think I had an idea, but Steve made it all possible. So great job, Steve.
Well, it's the perfect joint effort. Thank you, too, Miguel. Good night, everyone.
Good night.